morning. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show this week, we'll be talking with Martha Nussbaum, the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, and her topic will be the Greek ideal of liberal education. Professor Nussbaum, glad to have you on the show.
Hello, Hugh. It's really good to be here.
Well, thank you very much for appearing. What we're going to do today is to talk a little bit about the Greek understanding of liberal education, and perhaps it'd be helpful to give the listener a little bit more information about you. Though your title indicates that you're simply in law and ethics, in fact, as I understand it, you have appointments in the philosophy department, the law school, and the divinity school, and at least associate appointments in the classics department and gender studies. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
And my main profession is I'm
a
philosopher, and then I ramify out into all these different areas.
Okay. What we want to do is talk about the idea of liberal education, and the way to get into it, perhaps, is to contrast what you sometimes in your work have called a traditional view of education with the idea of liberal education. Maybe briefly explain both, and then we'll elaborate on those in the remainder of the show.
Yeah, well, the Greeks had an idea that I think some of us also have, that the best way to educate young people is to bring them up in the traditions of a community and to teach them to internalize those traditions. But the idea of liberal education began as a reaction against that. The thought that Socrates had was that people didn't think critically enough. They absorbed habits. But they didn't really look at those habits and whether they really wanted to make them their own. And in that way, they were going through life like automata. They weren't really their own people. So Socrates' idea was that you have to lead a life that involves self-examination, an examination of your traditions and whether you really think they hold together or not. So that was the root of the idea that I like. And then the Stoic philosophers who came several centuries later than Socrates developed it further, and they noted that the word liberal, the Latin word that we get our word liberal from, really means connected to freedom. And what they said is you've only got a liberal education if you've got an education that makes you a free person. That means able to take charge of your own reasoning and reason for yourself, not just deferring to the authority of whether it's of your teachers or of your parents.
Okay, so the idea of freedom is not just the absence, for example, the absence of governmental constraint, but the idea that your life is somehow chosen by yourself.
No, it's not really a political view in the first instance at all. It's a view about the mind and its own life. And, well, they connected it often to political republicanism because they thought that people who were in charge of their own life would rather like to run their own political life. But it started as a view about what's a worthwhile life for a person to lead. And the idea is you're not really fully human if you just parrot someone else's views all through your life and you don't ever ask whether you want to make those your own. So the idea was that education should be a wakening up and a leading out of the mind. Educare means to lead forth. And so the idea is you lead the person forth from the stupor of just moving through life by habit to a life where they really can take charge of themselves and know what they themselves stand for.
The Greeks, though, at least some number of the Greeks, were opposed to this idea of a liberal education. As you mentioned at the beginning, they had an idea that what the role of education could be is to enculturate the youth, to bring up the youth in the traditions of the community, to help people take their place within that community. Could you elaborate a bit on what their objections were to the Socratic view? Why were they so concerned, so afraid of it?
I think it's natural to feel that when your children start asking questions about what you told them, and they start saying, well, what does this mean, really? Is this really right? Do I really want to live the way you live? That there's something very threatening about that, because we all, as parents, want to impart our values to our children, and the Greeks were no different from anyone else. So they produced comic and satirical version of the Socratic education that had a terrible scare story where a young man who's gone to Socrates as a teacher suddenly goes back home and he says, oh, now I'm going to produce a good argument to show that I should beat my father. And then he produces this argument and the father is totally bewildered and confused. But then at the end of the play, the father comes over to Socrates' school and takes a torch and burns it down, and we don't even know whether the son is inside there. So it's a story of family disaster caused by questioning. And I think we all have that fear. And of course, in our country, parents send their children away to college and they don't see them and they think, what's happening there? Are they going to hate me? And are they going to come home and beat me? So I think the Greeks had the same worry that we easily have in our day.
Well, that worry is not just a worry of parents. It's certainly a worry that's been expressed in the public arena. People like Alan Bloom in criticizing what they see as certain trends in modern education. Are the concerns of people like Bloom much like the concerns that some of the Greeks had?
Well, Bloom is a very complicated and slippery character. Now, on the one hand, Socrates is one of his great heroes, and his whole posture in parts of his book is we want the genuine life of reason, and we don't want trendy posturing, and we don't want just fashion and fad. And, you know, that part of Bloom I would be basically sympathetic with, but I think that if you probe further, you find that he actually is quite scornful of certain kinds of questioning. I mean, he really doesn't want women to be asking questions about the traditional education, whether it was too male. He really doesn't want Americans to be asking questions about patriotism and whether it doesn't maybe deaden us to concern for the rest of the world. So he is at heart conservative, and there's a distinct limit on the questioning that he's prepared to admit. So I think that in the end, the book turns out to be a very conservative book, but it does put forward a kind of veneer of Socratism at the beginning. So he's kind of torn between the two educations, but he comes out on the more conservative side.
Okay, and as you're using the term conservative and liberal here, the main difference, the conservative is someone who basically doesn't want to question or only permit limited questioning of traditions. And the liberal is someone who says that you at least ought to be able to question them if you do not actually do so.
Yeah, I'm using these terms in an right. educational sense, not in their political sense at all. And by conservative, I mean somebody who thinks we should stick to the time-honored values and guide our life by those and not engage in very much questioning of them. And of course, liberal in the sense that it's used in these educational debates just means the person who believes in Socrates' idea of the examined life, who believes in freeing the mind from tradition and letting it take its own course, guided, of course, by reason and logic, but not necessarily guided by tradition unless the person decides that that's what they really want to endorse.
Well, now, is there something wrong with tradition?
Well,
is that part of the Socratic ideal?
You know, it's very interesting that Socrates, in the end of the day, I think he was very sympathetic to quite a lot of the traditions of his society, but he just thought that they wouldn't last long and they wouldn't do the work they ought to do if they weren't, if people didn't ask themselves what they really wanted to keep and what they didn't want to keep. So, for example, he does clearly make it clear that he thinks democracy is the best form of government, and he says he's like a gadfly on the back of democracy, which he calls a noble but sluggish horse. Now, I think what he means there is that if we go through life as in a democracy by sound bites, by advertising, by slogans, then we're not really awake. And although democracy is a noble horse, and I think he meant by that most of its basic ideas are pretty good ones, nonetheless, if the horse is asleep, it's not going to do very well in a race against some other kind of regime. So it's a way of getting the best out of the values we have by scrutinizing them, by throwing out the ones that are inconsistent with other ones that we hold. But it doesn't mean, of course, that you throw out the whole bag of them. You couldn't possibly, because what Socrates asks you to do is to start from where you are and scrutinize the beliefs you hold and ask which among those you really care about most deeply. So you're never asked to throw them all out. You test some against others, and you see which are the ones that are really deepest and best.
Okay, so the idea of the liberal is not someone who automatically throws traditions out. What they do is they question them. They may find themselves rejecting some of them, modifying others, and accepting some. But on Socrates' view, they'd somehow better appreciate or understand even those that they accept.
Yeah, I think they have a deeper understanding of the full reach and value of their own convictions. I mean, let me just give an example from the contemporary debate. I think a lot of what the new area of women's studies has done is to challenge the disciplines to think about their norms in the light of an idea of equality that at some level all Americans endorse. So Americans have always said that all people are created equal, but they haven't always meant it, or they haven't really thought it through. So they haven't really thought about what it would mean to think through this, the idea that women are fully equal. And what women's studies people say is, well, it might really mean some very serious changes in the way we think about biology, about psychology, in the way that, let's say, medical schools teach which paradigms of the human body they view as central. It may also mean a different way of thinking about work and the economy, where we start valuing women's housework and we don't just shove it to the periphery. We think that that is productive labor. And so in all those ways, thinking through the idea of equality leads you to make some maybe quite radical changes in the way you think about a discipline, but that's because you're holding on to and working through a noble idea that you already held.
Okay, so the challenge actually often provides a better way of understanding the tradition itself, or at least an elaboration on that tradition.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, that you really haven't, if you're just doing something because your parents told you to do it, then that's not, doesn't give very much respect to that tradition itself. I mean, most often people want their own ideas to be accepted by others because they're right or because they're noble, not just because somebody said, well, you better believe it. And so too with a tradition. You don't really respect it if you don't think it through and think why it's right, if you just repeat it and parrot it.
Well, now, what are some of the skills that one would acquire in an education that would enhance the chance of being able to criticize a tradition in the kind of way you've been talking about?
Well, I think I talk about really three different kinds of skills. Of course, I'm talking about the humanities, not about science now, but three within that part of a liberal education that are most important. And I think the first is just the ability to reason logically, to test what you say or read for consistency, for argumentation. And so, for example, to be able to read a newspaper editorial or listen to a political speech and to ask the question, does this all hang together? Does this conclusion follow from what was said before? And this is a very basic human ability that small children quite readily have, but of course it needs to be developed and further refined, because we often glide over things that don't make much sense and we don't realize that they don't make sense. So that's the first. The second is just the ability to think beyond your immediate context, the ability to think of yourself not just as an American who lives in Chicago, as I do, but as a citizen of a very complex interlocking world. The Stoics added this to Socrates' idea because they were already living in a complex interlocking world, and they were well aware that people are often thinking in too narrow a way, and that damages their relationship with their fellow citizens in the world, because they just make assumptions that come from their own context, and then they don't test them against the experiences of people who live elsewhere or who think differently. So my second suggestion is that we really need to learn that kind of worldwide thinking, thinking about how problems that might be similar arise differently in different contexts, how human beings experience life in different contexts. And then the third, which is closely connected to that, is an idea of the imagination. I think learning some facts about another part of the world is one thing we have to do, but they don't make sense. They don't really add up to much in the way of understanding unless we cultivate our ability to imagine what the world looks like to a person who's differently situated, whether it's a woman or a person in another country or what have you. And that, again, is something the Stoics really laid great stress on. They said that you really can't understand what somebody's saying unless you have entered into that person's mind and seen the action from that person's own point of view or understood the statement from their point of view. So I think that means the arts and literature, music, and so on have a very big place in cultivating the kind of citizen that I have in mind, and a liberal education can't afford to do without a great deal of place for the arts.
Okay, I want to pursue that in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause for a moment for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Martha Nussbaum, the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, and our topic is the Greek ideal of liberal education. Okay, I want to build on what you were just talking about, the kinds of skills that one acquires. And I know that one of the particular concerns that you have in your book, Cultivating Humanity, which I found quite fascinating, is the role of what you call multicultural education. Some critics have expressed great concern that we're no longer just reading the sacred canon in our schools, that we're not just reading Shakespeare, but we're also reading the works of women, minority groups, and they've questioned that. And you think, in fact, that's a mistake, that familiarizing yourself with the work of people outside the tradition is a very important part of what it is to be a liberally educated person. And
yes.
It seems to me it ties in with those skills you just mentioned. Perhaps you could just begin by elaborating on that, and then we can pursue it a little bit further.
Yeah, sure. Of course, as a classicist by training, I know that these canons get put together by all kinds of accidents. I mean, what survived in the sands of Egypt, and so it just survived by accident a lot of the time. And then, of course, I know well that a lot of the works I'd most like to read from the ancient Greeks are lost. So I came to this topic with a healthy, I think, skepticism about the canon. But I think that when we're thinking about how we deal with people who are different from ourselves, whose lives we have a hard time understanding, one of the most important sources of understanding is to read works written from those traditions. And so you can justify the inclusion of non-standard works in the canon simply by that imperative of better mutual understanding. I mean, if we're going to, let's say, break down some of the barriers of racial suspicion and misunderstanding in this country, well, one way to do it certainly is to have more integration in the classroom itself and to learn in personal encounters much more about the lives of others. But sometimes that's very hard. As Marcel Proust said, a real person imposes a dead weight that your sensitivity cannot remove. And he meant it's very hard to see what another person is thinking if that person is not only different from you, but, of course, suspicious of you for various historical reasons. So fiction is a great aid, I think, in understanding the problems that we face in our society when we deal with differences of race and gender and class. It's not sufficient all by itself. We need the personal encounters, too, and we need historical facts, too. But it's a very, very important part. So, for example, if I'm teaching my law students a course in law and literature, I want to make sure to include novels by African Americans, such as Native Son by Richard Wright and Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, because I think those novels take them much further into what they need to understand as lawyers who are going to be dealing with problems of race than even a casual encounter with African American students in their own classroom could ever do. So I think there's a very good rationale for making these non-canonical texts part of the education for everyone. Now, I think it's a legitimate fear that this multicultural education is introduced merely as a strategy of identity politics. That is, you know, it would be very bad if African Americans said, oh, we're going to go off and read African American fiction, and you can go off and read white fiction. That would defeat the whole purpose, in my view, which is that we should all try to do more to understand each other. And so I'm in favor of classrooms that are fully pluralistic and reading lists that are thoroughly pluralistic. I think if we say, too, that only African Americans can teach African American fiction, then the natural response to that is, well, does that mean that only whites can teach white fiction? Well, surely not. What we want to say is this effort of understanding should be made by all of us in as many ways as we possibly can, and the classroom should be a place where we're precisely struggling to overcome the obstacles that history and mutual suspicion have placed in our way.
All right, so the literature of groups with which we're not familiar will certainly help develop two of those skills, at least two of those skills that you talked about, taking us beyond our immediate context, helping us understand people who are different from us, how they live, how they think, how they relate, and also stimulating the imagination in certain kinds of ways. I wonder if you could maybe give an example from some literature about how the literature might serve those purposes.
Well, all right, let's take Native Son, since I mentioned that. Now, in the novel, there is a part near the beginning where the young white University of Chicago student Mary Dalton is being driven by Bigger Thomas, her African-American chauffeur, to her class at the University of Chicago, and they're going down Lakeshore Drive, and she points up at some looming tenements on probably around 31st Street, I think it's supposed to be, and she says, you know, Bigger, I've never been inside of those apartment buildings, but she said, I'd really like to go in and see how your people live. Now, of course, she adds, they must live the way we do because they're human. Now, that's very revealing because it shows that she really hasn't been able to understand the difference between her privileged life and Bigger's very, very different life. However, from page one of the novel, the reader has been inside that so-called apartment building and has seen what it's like for four people to live crowded together in a single room where they can't undress without hiding behind the furniture, where they can't begin to eat breakfast until somebody's killed a big rat with a frying pan. So the vivid description of that enclosed, imprisoned life has been with the reader all along. And I think that passage in the novel is, as it were, self-referential. It's saying, wouldn't it have been better if Mary Dalton had had different classes at the University of Chicago where she would precisely have learned the things that she doesn't know now?
Could you say a little bit more about how it is that literature stimulates the imagination? Is it just reading someone else's words? Are there certain techniques, perhaps, that gets used? Or I'm just trying to get a little bit better handle on what it is and how it is that literature serves its purpose of encouraging, developing, expanding the imagination.
Well, of course, how to do it is a great mystery, and I think, you know, if we understood how great writers produce great literature, if we could reduce that to formula, we'd probably all be doing it. But so I don't claim to have a theory of how art is made, but I do think that works of distinguished literature have a power to draw us into a relationship of intimacy and deep emotion with people where, in real life, if we met them, we would not be able to have a relationship with them at all. So we get to know something about Bigger Thomas. Now, of course, the relationship is that the Wright sets up between the reader and Bigger Thomas is very complicated. It involves showing how difficult it is to understand his emotions and how an easy sympathy is actually not going to be possible because his character and his thoughts have been warped by the world that he's been living in. So I think Wright quite cannily repels an easy and facile relationship of pity to Bigger. But he then cultivates the much deeper and more politically pertinent kind of sympathy of getting the reader to say, wouldn't it have been terrible to have been a little child in that world? Maybe I, too, would have murdered somebody. And maybe I, too, would have been so enraged and so enclosed in that world that I wouldn't have been the good person that I pride myself on being. So in that way, I think it cultivates all kinds of thoughts about how character and circumstance are shaped by their social setting, how even something so simple as the ability to hope is shaped by a social setting. And so I think, you know, fiction does this by hooking us in, by giving us pleasure in the act of imagining these complicated scenes, and by entertaining us, by making us follow the plot. Ralph Ellison wrote in his preface to Invisible Man that novels can be rafts of hope, perception, and entertainment that can help the democracy negotiate the snags and whirlpools that they encounter on the way to the democratic ideal. And I think that's a wonderful image, the idea being that the pleasure and the entertainment is wrapped up with the perception. The raft is built of both, so that if the novel is not entertaining, if it's just a sermon, then you're not going to learn from it what you can learn. But by drawing you in and getting you involved with these lives, then the novel is able to awaken emotions that you may never have felt.
Okay, so it some way transports us to possibilities that we just certainly have never had and perhaps never could have.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask, because you've talked about, you use language of sympathy, pity, and other terminology that suggest a certain moral dimension that arises from or can be prompted by the imagination. And I know that's something that you've dealt with in some of your other works. I wonder if in the last 3 minutes of the show you can talk a little bit about that, the way in which imagination, which is going to be part of a liberal education, can actually make us more sensitive, more caring, more understanding human beings.
Well, I think one of the greatest problems we have as human beings is obtuseness and deadness to the sufferings of others. And, of course, we need ethical theories to inform us about what we ought to care about and on what basis. Emotions all by themselves don't do that, because we can sometimes have emotions that are directed at the wrong thing, or we often feel sympathy for just our own family and we don't have sympathy for someone who looks different from ourselves. So I think these emotions and the imagination that goes with them are not reliable in and of themselves, but I think that if you kind of think about how a good theory of human concern, I mean, let's say we have the idea that we all ought to be concerned for all human beings and we ought to help them in certain ways, how could that become real in a human being, in a human life? The answer has to include the cultivation of the imagination and the emotions, I think, because we can't do good for other people by duty alone, even if we want to, because we don't understand what we would be doing for them if we haven't tried to think what it's like to be them. So that if you have somebody who's, let's say, take a public example, a judge who's trying to do the right thing in settling a case of sexual harassment in the workplace. Well, he has to be able to imagine what it's like to be a woman, and then he has to be able to pose the question, is this a hostile and threatening environment or not? Now, that takes imagination, and if that person has never exercised imagination up until that time, probably the person will do a bad job. And there are all kinds of ways, all through our lives, public and private, but where we have to pose these questions. How hostile is something? How difficult are certain conditions? How worthy of being aided is this suffering person? And we can't answer them, I think, without the ability to try to put ourselves in that place and to do it with refinement as people who have imagined something before and who've been practicing that since childhood.
Okay, in the last 30 seconds or so, could you sum up and talk about how this ties in again with the notion of liberal education?
Yes, I think liberal education in this country has moved a long way. I think we're doing a lot better at trying to use the opportunity of liberal education to acquaint ourselves with the people that we live with in this world. And the way that I want to do this is to lay great emphasis on the ability to take ourselves outside our narrow, smug selves and to be able to come into contact with the reality of distant lives through history, through the imagination, and through thinking about ethical difficulties. And I think, actually, our colleges and universities are moving along very, very well on the whole on those problems.
Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you very much, Hugh. I enjoyed it.
And speaking today with Martha Nussbaum, the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, this is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.